Hey everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. As you know, we took last week off because we figured a fair chunk of our audience would be focused on the US election, and yeah, that was, I think, a good decision because it felt like the whole world was glued to America's election coverage basically all week, but it is done now. I mean, I want to say it's done now. And there were no cyber shenanigans, which was a nice relief. However, a cyber-related conspiracy theory has bubbled up out of the right-wing fringe media fever swamp. We will take a look at that one in a little while. This week's show is brought to you by Remediant. They make a product that removes privilege from your network accounts and then lets you re-enable that privilege in a time-locked way. Remediant co-founder Paul Lanzi is joining us this week to talk through an alternative use case for their technology, ransomware recovery. One of their MSP customers approached them to see if they could help with evicting a ransomware crew from one of their customers' environments, and it actually went pretty well. So they've now done about six of those, and Paul's going to stop by with the details in a little while. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, Zoom has settled with the FTC for misleading consumers when it came to the state of their security and encryption. No fine. They've just agreed to a bunch of undertakings.
Yeah, I mean, they've come out and said that they're going to have their product audited and do a bunch of other assessment of their environments because of the, you know, the focus that they put on security after, you know, the rise of Zoom during COVID. But yeah, no fine, I suppose, is not super unreasonable. I mean, it's clear that they have done a lot of work since, you know, security kind of got rubbed in their face a little bit. And the FTC probably has a bunch of other people who've done a lot worse that do deserve fines, so...
Yeah, I mean, this mostly centered on their claims to offer E2EE, which they kind of didn't. They're like, well, it's encrypted on this end and it's encrypted on that end, so it's E2EE. It's like, guys, that's not how it works. But yeah, certainly they did engage in a pretty massive security effort in good faith, you would have to admit.
Yeah, I think so. And there's, you know, there's a lot of vendors that perhaps wouldn't have done that quite so well. So, you know, I'm glad the FTC, I guess, is giving them a little bit of room to, you know, having done it properly so far to, you know, now continue to do so. But, you know, it's a good reminder to everybody else that you can't just make up marketing words about your product as relates to security and get away with it 100% of the time.
Now, I want to paint a picture for you here. Adam, the year is 2013, right? The year is 2013. You're a hacker. You know, you're sitting at home drinking your Mountain Dew, whatever it is you're doing, right? You're on your computer. You're on the dark web and you think, hey, I'm going to have a bit of a poke at Silk Road because they're not going to call the cops. They're criminals. Ha ha. So I'm going to go steal their Bitcoin. You steal $350,000 of Bitcoin in 2013. And then you sit there watching it grow in value to $1 billion. Knowing that if you touch it, you're probably going to go to prison. Talk us through the goings on the blockchain this week, because this is a great story.
Yes, the stash of Bitcoin, which was kind of traced through DPR and the Silk Road, and had been kind of sitting around. I went through some tumblers on the far side of the Silk Road, came out the other side. Got stolen by somebody, and it sounds like the hacker in question who did it, DPR, managed to figure out who it was, and there was some kind of, you know, threatening situation. Anyway, for whatever reason, the hacker decided to sit on it, and this is now the fourth largest single Bitcoin wallet, you know, on the blockchain, and yeah, it's been sitting around. There's a lot of people kind of allegedly trading copies of the wallet.dat file, saying, hey, if you crack this,
you'll get
all of these Bitcoins, which, you know, no one really knows whether that was, you know, the legit wallet.dat, whether that's just people scamming, you know, other people on Russian forums, but yeah, it's been sitting idle for years and years, and yeah, finally the hacker that controlled that Bitcoin wallet, presumably as the person who originally stole it from the Silk Road, came to some arrangement, the details of which were a little bit unclear about, with the US government to hand it over. And as you painted in the picture, that must have felt... You must have felt something.
Yes.
Handing over the private key for $1 billion.
Yeah, I think they rightfully stole. I think they did spend like 20 grand or something, like, out of the wallet back in the day, you know, like in 2015 or something. But yeah, they've just been sitting there watching it go nuts. And of course, when the Bitcoin moved, there were all these stories like, oh my God, somebody cracked the wallet and whatever. And then eventually, yeah, out came the release from DOJ saying, lol, that was us. I'm guessing the deal here was like, give us the $1 billion and we won't prosecute you, you know? I mean, that seems like a happy resolution for everyone, really. I mean, except the guy who lost $1 billion. But except the guy, at least he's not going to prison.
Well, yeah, and I guess that's got to be worth something. Whether that's worth $1 billion, I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, like what a feeling, right? I mean, I can't imagine what that feels like to have, you know, have $1 billion in your grasp that you can't touch except to buy your way out of jail.
And you'd like to think that money is going into general coffers, you know, US government coffers. It'll be spent on schools and the welfare of the people. I kid.
Oh dear.
Yes. Lockheed's getting a new contract for something.
They're going to get a new quarter of a boat, maybe.
Yes, that's right. Moving on. And Mandiant has dropped a report on a group it calls UNC 1945. And I got to say, this crew seems pretty cool.
We do have some quiet respect for, you know, hacker crews that operate in ways that seem near and dear to our heart. This particular crew has been going after Solaris boxes with a sweet Solaris remote that they bought on a forum for $3,000.
Yeah, but it's O'Day too. I mean, this is not a patched bug. Like, yeah, we're talking Solaris SSH O'Day. Let's party like it's 1999, you know?
I mean, you know, past me would have really, really loved that bug. I mean, everyone loves SSH remotes, I guess. But yeah, this is a crew that's been shelling Solaris boxes, as you say, in the old style. And then they have a bunch of other tools that they've been using, you know, once they're in their back doors and other bits and pieces that, you know, really kind of warm my heart. I mean, one of the tricks they use is they actually bring in a QEMU virtual machine to run all of their stuff in so that when you look at the process listing, you just see one big QEMU process. And I'm assuming it's called like user bin Java instead of QEMU, where they're running all of their bits and pieces inside.
That reminds me of that ransomware. That ransomware that was using VMware, and it would just like give unlimited disk, you know, unlimited access to disk, and then they'd encrypt that way and like bypass all the AV and stuff. It's pretty funny.
I mean, it's a great way to do it. And I mean, I have also, you know, rolled virtual machines onto other people's machines, you know, during the process of making myself at home. So yeah, it's a great way to go about it. And I'm surprised more people don't do it that way. So yeah, this is a crew that I feel, you know, some empathy with.
Sammy Kamkar is, you know, a hacker known for coming up with cool tricks, and he's dropped one he calls NAT slipstreaming, which is cool. It's just cool, clever, typical Sammy Kamkar sort of stuff.
Yeah, look, this is just beautiful stunt hacking, and I don't know that a whole bunch of people are going to get owned with it in the real world.
It doesn't matter
because it's a beautiful thing. So this is a trick whereby you use a combination of browser, you know, things that a browser does, and the firewall inspection done by NAT routers on the edge of people's networks, you know, typically in a home environment or whatever, to convince the NAT router to open up a connection back in so that you can then talk to internal services on the network, getting around the address translation. And it does so by, like, protocol confusion in the protocol inspection of the NAT router. So if you're making, you know, some network protocols have requirements to open up other ports, typically things like media streaming, you know, voice over IP, telephony, that kind of thing. And so the router has to inspect traffic going past and then figure out what ports it needs to open up. And the real beauty of this trick that Sammy pulls is convincing a browser behind the NAT gateway to make an outbound connection that in the middle of the like HTTP stream looks like a SIP packet. And then if you align that directly at the like the window size or directly at the size of the packets going past, such that it's at the beginning of a midstream TCP packet, the router in the middle misparses that as a whole new, you know, SIP telephony connection and believes what's in it and goes off and opens up a connection. And doing that requires a whole bunch of network jiggery pokery and understanding like the MTU of the connections and the segment sizes and, you know, all and network addressing, all sorts of fiddly stuff that Sammy has tricks to do, right? He's figured out the whole process end to end, and it's a beautiful piece of hacking. And honestly, quite difficult to fix. I mean, the root cause really is the, you know, kind of sloppy parsing of network protocols in the kind of application inspection on the Linux kernel. And it's not just SIP, but there are other protocols that will do the same sort of thing. And so fixing that on everybody's embedded, you know, Huawei routers in their houses, not going to happen. And the rest of the behavior, like in the browser that you need, in the end, this is going to be a bug that lasts forever. And if you are cunning enough to use it, you'll probably get some sweet hacks out of it. So just good job, Sammy. I read that blog post and, you know, tears welled in my eyes. It was a beautiful thing.
Yes, yes. Very nicely done there, dude. What else have we got? Yeah, Brett Winiford for risky.biz. Like, this is a story that appeared on our website. He wrote up a piece about Australia's critical infrastructure protection laws, which are really hardcore, right? Like, I can't imagine too many countries just like putting a bill like this up for consideration. The upshot basically is that, you know, if you're deemed critical infrastructure, and that could be a, you know, like a power station or distribution center owned by one of the states or whatever, like if the federal government decides you're critical infrastructure, they're basically reserving the right to just roll in and like throw sensors on everything and steal your logs. And it's pretty hardcore. And yeah, Brett did a bit of analysis on that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty interesting piece of proposed legislation, and the level of access it would give is pretty wild. I mean, at the top end, the idea that the, you know, ASD can roll into your environments, be given shells and access, and just, you know, do what they please, like deploy sensors, read stuff, you know, modify data as they need to, you know, that's going to give a lot of people a lot of pause. On the other hand, you know, maybe this is where we're at. Maybe this is actually necessary.
I admit, too, that the cyber fascist within me thinks that this is pretty cool.
I mean, that's it, right? Like 15, 20 years old me wants to, you know, throw, you know, cyber Molotovs in the cyberpunk street or something. But, you know, having seen how the private sector, you know, manages its stuff, you know, as a security consultant for the last 15, 20 years, you know, maybe it's kind of necessary and not a terrible idea.
The thing is here, the states are pushing back on this because they think it's a little bit extreme. And I think one of the problems with it is that there's way too much ministerial discretion in it. So I think it might need a little bit of a tweak. But in general, you know, in general, I think it's we probably need something like this, you know?
Well, I mean, we were discussing around the office and one of my colleagues said, man, they must be getting owned by China really, really hard to be pitching this one. And yeah, I guess you wouldn't be doing this unless you needed it because, you know, it's a pretty serious business, you know, proposal.
Yeah, it is. I can't imagine anything even remotely like this getting up in the United States. But, you know, the times they change. So let's see. You never know. We got one of those sites, citoday.in. You know, it's like leaked source. It was one of those sites that brought together breached databases, but was marketed to hacker forums, sort of like an evil have I been pwned. It shut down a while back and it had a FBI notice on it saying that it had been seized that everyone thinks was actually faked. So no one really knows what the go is with this site, but the point is all of the data that it had aggregated is now out there. I think this just shows that once data's been breached, it's been breached. Also it shows that when you aggregate this stuff, it can be quite powerful.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, the reports of the data set for this particular site is that it wasn't particularly exciting. It was, you know, quite a lot of fairly low-rent sites in their set of data. But yeah, when you aggregate it, when you repackage it, and that's, you know, inevitably what happens, right, is there's a whole kind of, you know, life cycle of leak aggregation sites and forums and trading and whatever. And eventually, yeah, you do end up with quite a useful data set. And even if it is from, you know, kind of not particularly significant sites, it does add up. And you're right, this stuff just lives forever and is always going to be traded, you know, even if the, you know, particular links that were, you know, where the data was posted in the last few days, you know, didn't last particularly long, it's already popped up in, you know, a bunch of other places.
So I think what you're saying is, given that it's old and not from premium enterprise networks, these are just sparkling creds. Not champagne, just sparkling creds.
Exactly.
Yeah. We've got a couple of pieces on North Korea here. This one I find really interesting because we did see the US government release some samples relating to a North Korean crew, and the private sector, you know, pulled the threads a little. And Cyber Reason was able to tie, you know, to basically cluster a whole bunch of other stuff to this North Korean crew because of the release from the US government. I mean, that's what this stuff is for. So it's just nice to see this in action.
Yeah, I mean, they managed to pull the threads and tie together, you know, a couple of other kind of post-intrusion bits and pieces and be able to attribute them to campaigns. And yeah, you're right. That's the goal of all this, is to just, you know, iteratively burn their tool chain and their techniques and things in a way that kind of lets the private sector do a bunch of the heavy lifting, you know, without burning too much, you know, American gov'd capability and, you know, sources and methods. But yeah, just, you know, a little release here and there does make all the difference to being able to tie, you know, individual clusters together in ways that then, you know, we can, you know, infer some actionable things about.
Yep. McAfee dropped a report on the North Korean crew that was running around doing the, like, was it like LinkedIn-based ownage? That's how they were doing it, wasn't it?
Yeah, this was the, like, sending people fake job ads for people who are, you know, kind of loosely related to the defense industrial industries. Yeah, sending them LinkedIn job ads, and probably pretty effective.
Yeah, yeah. So there's some more detail on that. But while we're talking about North Korea, we actually published a story written by Daniel Gordon, who's a threat hunter or threat intelligence guy in the defense industrial base. He tracks a lot of these groups. And he wrote a great piece for us. Brett worked on it as well. But he wrote a great piece for us, really looking at how what some people call the Lazarus group is actually a whole bunch of different clusters of activity. So if you wanted to see a single story that actually goes through and looks at these different groups and how they cluster, this is a good one.
Yeah, and it does kind of compare both the technical aspects of the individual groups, like why they're different from a technical attribution point of view, but also in their approach and, you know, how they go about, you know, undertaking their attacks and what sort of things they're looking into. So yeah, if you're into trying to figure out how to simulate individual adversaries, then understanding these nuances is really important.
Staying with Asia, and the Qianfu Cup just took place in China. And man, there were so many good bugs. This is like the homegrown Chinese pwn-to-own equivalent, and just the volume and quality of the bugs that contestants were able to demonstrate. Really, like, you know, Catalin Kimpanu wrote this up for ZDNet. We ran with it in yesterday's newsletter. And, you know, our take on this is that this really shows how far China has come in terms of developing a, you know, a local scene that does this sort of elite exploit development work. And it's really a sign that, you know, for as much as these, you know, think tank driven cyber power matrices might say China's catching up, okay, that's one thing. But then you look at this and it's something tangible that just says, okay, maybe they've arrived. You know, can we be assured that the United States has sort of dominance in exploit development? I don't think that's a safe call anymore.
No, I mean, you know, you look at the quality of the bugs and the range of targets that they're hitting, and I mean, you know, Chinese exploit devs have always been pretty good, but just seeing it laid out like this, I mean, in a competition where you've got, you know, a very clear understanding of what the targets are and what the situation is, because I mean, often there's, you know, if you're hacking in a real environment, there's, it can be a little bit difficult to figure out exactly what kind of bugs were used where, and, you know, it can be a little bit murky. You know, in these circumstances, in a competition, it's very clear, right? We have, you know, up-to-date iOS 14 running on an iPhone 11, they've got a, you know, browser bug that leads to a kernel bug that leads to, you know, code exec's root or whatever, you know, whatever the bug chain does. And that's pretty cut and dried. And you've also got the issue of the price, right? There's an actual, you know, prize for doing it. And you can kind of get an idea of how much they value these things, right? If you're going to go and throw them away, you know, in what's effectively kind of an arms parade, right? It's like driving through the middle of Pyongyang with your missile launches.
100%.
That's the same sort of thing, right? I mean, you're making a statement with these bugs because you could have kept them. And the fact that you don't care about them and you're willing to throw them away, you know, for some, you know, to make a nice show and, you know, and not actually keep them to use, that's, you know, it says something.
That's it. It's flex, right? And I did speak to someone in the sort of exploit business, you know, and they said for sure some of these disclosures would have burned someone's capability at least, right? Like there will be people running around with their hair on fire because some of these bugs were disclosed.
Well, exactly right. And if you know whose bugs they are and you're willing to go and throw them away, you know, just to kind of rub their nose in it, that's pretty funny as well. I mean,
well, that was an angle that we did consider for the newsletter, but we didn't go with it because it's speculation. But this would be an excellent way to surface bugs that you've actually caught in the wild being used against your systems. You know, just like, just give a hot tip to one of the contestants. Hey, you might want to, you know, have a look for this bug here.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You don't really know what games are being played. And, you know, at the very least, right, we know that there's some very, very solid exploit researchers and devs, you know, in that scene doing amazing work. And, you know, we don't want to, you know, I don't want to discount it and say, oh, well, they got, you know, tip-offs from the Ministry of State Security or whatever. Like, there's a lot of very legit bugs there, and I'm sure they worked real hard.
Those competitions
are really hard work.
That's why we didn't go there, right? Because it's speculation and we don't really wear tinfoil hats around the office, right? So that's the thing. Moving on, and a major ransomware strain from Windows land has now been ported over to Linux. Now, we don't know what ransomwaring in a Linux environment is going to look like, whether or not it's going to cause the same sorts of disruption as ransomwaring, you know, a Windows network. We know what the consequences of that are. But we also know that Linux environments typically aren't as well instrumented and, you know, monitored and protected as Windows networks, generally speaking. So when you see news like this, it sort of makes you go a little bit oomph.
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, we haven't seen widespread ransomware on non-Windows platforms. You know, it's only been pretty minor stuff. And seeing a real, you know, a crew that's had a bunch of experience, has already, you know, exercised how to do it in a Windows environment, go and port some tools across to Unix, does suggest some intent. And you're right, we don't really know how it's going to play out. I mean, there's a couple of points on either side, right? I mean, the Unix environments tend to be less well integrated in terms of, you know, both logging, but also authorization. I mean, the idea of, you know, owning a Windows environment, you pop the AD with a known kind of technique, and then you can instantly move laterally. You know how to do it. You know how the tools are going to work. There's not a whole bunch of variation there. In a Unix environment, there's so many ways to do it, and they're all dumb. And moving in a very large Unix environment, you know, moving around laterally is going to take some site local understanding of the environment, and that slows you down. So that will hamper a widespread use of, you know, ransomware on Linux, because the speed of deploying it is a bit less good. On the other hand, detection and response on Unix is so terrible and so far behind where we are on Windows that when someone gets ransomware, figuring out what happened and evicting the attacker is going to be, you know, even more impossible and intractable than it is on Windows. So,
well, yeah, and if these guys have success in one environment and that hits the news, guess what every other crew is going to do?
Of course, like everyone's going to want to go there as well. And you know, we've already seen that trend away from ransomware in Windows workstations and towards Windows servers. And it makes sense to go and do the same thing on, you know, database systems or, you know, web servers or other things, you know, that are, you know, quite often going to be running Unix. So, yeah, I'm interested to see how this plays out because, yeah, if a couple of the crews get some big wins on the board and manage to make a bunch of money and it's really effective, then we will see, you know, a pretty rapid pivot, I'm sure, because there's so much money to be made doing this kind of thing and relatively safely.
Yeah. Sean Lingus at CyberScoop reports that a ransomware attack at the University of Vermont Health Network has forced one of the network's hospitals to delay chemotherapy and mammogram appointments. I mean, this is, you know, just a case study in the real world tangible impacts of this stuff. And this didn't happen the other day. Like this, the compromise started on October 25.
Yeah, so it's going back a little bit, and we haven't seen the, you know, kind of widespread attacks on healthcare that we were worried about, but it doesn't take very many for it to really affect people's lives. And this is, an example of how, you know, the idea that doctors are reduced to using bits of paper and not being able to update patient records because of ransomware is just, you know, even on the case of, you know, this, which is what, six hospitals, you know, it's still really, really distressing to see.
Yeah, and they still haven't brought it back up. There was that panic that sort of kicked off after our last show, actually, where, oh my God, 400 hospitals are about to get ransomwared, and, you know, it was the end was coming. It was really interesting watching the reaction to that, because this time people were very, very hardcore. We had people like Richard Baitlick saying that, you know, the US government needs to consider a presidential finding that would authorize covert action against these crews. Like, it really does feel like the discourse is moving in the direction that we started going down, you know, that road that we started going down, you know, a year or two ago, which is interesting because the UHS attack was actually a successful attack against hundreds of hospitals, and we didn't see any of that then, right? So I don't know what's changed. But this most recent round of coverage, and it turned out to be a bit of a fizzer. I mean, yes, some hospitals did get ransomwared, but it wasn't the disaster we were all thinking it was going to be. And I don't know why. I don't know if that's because, you know, maybe Cybercom went and intervened, or maybe the attackers backed down, or maybe some blue teamers managed to get on top of it because everyone was sharing, sharing information on it. But it's been a really interesting couple of weeks for ransomware, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's so hard to say, right, in these, you know, in this scene, right? I mean, it could equally just be, you know, a bunch of people talking up big ideas on forums, right? You don't know how serious these people are, you know, and, it, you know, the quality of the information, you know, when the sources are kind of so far away from where decisions are being made, it can just be really, really difficult. And, you know, we're probably not going to know. And, you know, as you said, maybe it was CyberCon went in and sorted it out. I don't know.
Probably not. I mean, I was just floating that as a, you know, as just one idea. It could be anything. I mean, it could be, you know, Martians came and stopped it. Like, we just, we don't know. Brian Krebs actually has a story on his site about a report from a company called Coveware that says that paying ransomware operators to delete data is a bad idea because they have looked at cases where people are paid and the data tends to wind up being disclosed anyway.
Which, you know, you don't really know whether that's because there's only one crew in the environment or whether the people who are, you know, running these operations are themselves also owned or whether they're just dishonest, you know, criminals to start with. Hard to say. But yeah, I think everyone's generally agreed that paying ransoms, you know, for whatever reasons, be it to, you know, delete stuff they've taken, be it to give you keys back, whatever it is, it's probably not going to go particularly well.
Well, but I mean, that's the only way a lot of companies wind up recovering is to pay, right? But maybe paying to delete stuff is not the way to go.
No, I don't know that that's the best idea at all.
No. Apparently, a whole bunch of Israeli companies are being smashed with a new variant of ransomware called Pay2Key. Capcom, the games company, the Japanese games company, they've faced some sort of attack. It just says cyber attack. I'm going to just say that's ransomware. We've got another one from Catalan saying that the company that runs US illegal immigration detention centers discloses ransomware attack. Feeling really conflicted on that one, got to be honest.
I know, right?
You mean the people who run the baby jails got ransomware'd? Oh.
But they stole the personal details of the babies.
I don't know. It hurts. Brain hurts. What else have we got? Yeah, then more reporting on the hospital stuff. Campari got ransomware. And we're coming into summer here in Australia, and if this affects the Campari supply, I'm going to be pretty disappointed. I've got to be honest. And Compal, the second largest laptop manufacturer in the world, they've been ransomware. Mattel, the toy company, they've been ransomware. I mean, it just keeps on and on and on it goes, right?
I mean, I guess at least it's nice to be talking about something that isn't the hospitals. I mean, you know, Barbie being ransomware or, you know, Wild Turkey production being interrupted. I mean, not ideal.
Wild Turkey, yes. I can handle, right? But Campari, man. Come on, I'm a classy guy. I'm a Campari guy, not a Wild Turkey.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, the ransomware situation just doesn't seem to be showing any signs of slowing down, and clearly they're still making money. And yeah, I don't know where it's gonna end up next year. I mean, we'll probably still be talking about it. Still be, you know, 50 stories a week.
Now, I think we spoke about this last time, but some BEC scammers ran off with $2.3 million from the Wisconsin Republican, like, operation. And now they've come out and they said, you know, we were going to use that money to try to help get Donald Trump reelected in Wisconsin. So, I mean, you know, we're talking about a BEC scam here that could have had a bit of an impact on the election. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say whether $2 million is enough to, you know, sway the outcome of the election. But hey, you know, if we're looking for stories about, you know, cyber impacts on the election, this is at least one, you know, that's a little more concrete than some of the other ones we've seen floated around the place.
Now, what the hell is a Sonar Cube and why are people getting their source code popped through their Sonar Cubes?
So Sonar Cube is a piece of software that does like static code analysis that typically you bolt into your like, you know, CI/CD process when your developers check in code. It gets run through that and it annotates a bunch of, you know, security flaws and other things they need to think about in their code bases. And I think it's one of these kind of open source products with a commercial, you know, kind of support arrangements. I think that's how it works. Anyway, it's typically distributed as a Docker container and the web app that is in that Docker container has default creds, and some people have been leaving it lying around on the internet, as people are rather want to do. Where this gets bad is because you're integrating this into your, you know, kind of code pipeline, typically it's going to have creds to read all of your source code, and somebody has figured this out, been scanning the internet for port 9000, logging in admin, and helping themselves to the source code for, you know, like Mexican banks and other people that have been using this particular product to improve their security. So that's a little bit awks.
Yes, that is a little bit awks. It's funny, right, because there's some of these companies that they become successful maybe a little bit quicker than they planned and they just make that one bad decision and it haunts them for years. Like I did a like a sponsored thing with MongoDB a while ago and talking to Ken White, and he's just like, man, we changed the defaults for MongoDB years ago, you know, like, and you're still seeing all the headlines about stuff, you know, stuff getting owned because it's just sitting out there with bad defaults, but they changed them. And it just, that stuff just hangs around forever. Anyway.
I mean, I think the real issue here is just how willing people are to take Docker containers or, you know, other kind of package systems
and run them
without looking, without even thinking about it, rather than the individual software. I mean, so.
But that's the thing. Yeah. You just have to assume that the people using your technology are like idiots, you know, like even though it's not necessarily idiotic, like that's not what I mean. I'm not calling them idiots. I'm not victim shaming here, but it's like that little gif of the person who picks up the glass of water and starts licking it, you know. It's just like, you got to assume people are going to use it wrong, right, for whatever reason. Deloitte launched a hacker IQ game that they had to pull offline because they left one of the like config files in a web accessible directory, and it had, you know, like MySQL creds in it and stuff, which, you know, it's not the end of the world and it's not really a production system, but it is a little bit embarrassing, right?
It is a little bit embarrassing, yeah. Some guy was poking around and found like it was a .git directory in the web root that had credentials in it, turned that into some access. Funny thing was the underlying box was like an out of support Ubuntu 14.04, so that's a little bit embarrassing as well. I think Deloitte said that it's actually run and hosted by some third party, you know, marketing company or something.
I mean, that's such an it's such an old school issue, and they're using such an old school excuse to match it, which is like, it's hosted by a third party. It's not on us, you know.
I'm pretty sure there's a poster that says hackers don't give a shit that it's hosted by a third party.
There is a poster. I'm looking at it right now because I have that one up in my office. What else have we got? The Russian Ministry of Internal Affairs has announced a 20-year-old Russian gentleman has been charged over crimes relating to malware, which isn't something you typically see in Russia, but this guy made the genius decision to actually target Russian organizations.
Yeah, you'd think that was pretty clear in the Russian underground, that maybe that was a thing that led to, you know, a rather short period of freedom. This guy was writing, he wrote some miners and some Trojans and some other bits and pieces, was using them himself and also selling them on forums, and did not respect the golden rule of not hacking Russians when you're Russian.
Maybe they'll send him off to do community service with one of the ransomware crews.
Send him down to GRU, get that man a uniform.
Part of his rehabilitation. Now, this next initiative, I support this. Now, people who listen to this program would know that we don't like using bug names, right? Because quite often they're sort of loaded and they're, you know, it's sort of marketing where you don't quite need marketing. But CertCC in the United States is launching a Twitter bot that's going to automatically assign like names to bugs. And I'm not against this. I don't have a problem with naming a bug. Like, it's awkward to try to memorize CVE numbers, but it's just the names that people were picking that rustled my jimmies, right? So I don't know. I think this could be good. You know, Seagoing Bat is one example we see here. Dashed Burro. You know, this works.
I don't know how I'm going to feel though when I'm writing a report for a customer and I have to say, and by the way, you are vulnerable to unneeded lobster.
But I mean, that's a contradiction, because who doesn't, that's an oxymoron. Like, when is a lobster unneeded? I could go lobster.
Exactly, right. And we're going to end up spending half the meeting talking about lobsters and thinking about dinner and not enough talking about how they got themselves shelled.
Garlic butter.
I mean, for how long this took, right? This is probably what, like an hour's worth of work to rig up a Twitter bot. You know, it's pretty funny. I don't know whether it's going to catch on overall. But you're right. It's better than some of the names that, you know, other people come up with.
Yeah, and it's guaranteed to, you know, belt out the occasional accidentally smutty one or something that we can all laugh about, right? So
exactly.
That'll be fun. Oracle's pushed an out-of-band security update, which it never does, but this is for WebLogic, because a whole bunch of their customers are getting rinsed in the wild right now.
Yeah, and this, you know, WebLogic obviously is in a lot of really important big applications, and bugs in it are bad. This particular bug was a bug in the, like, management interface, so not quite as bad as if it was accessible through the front end, but it was just, like, path traversal to code exec through the management port. Oracle fixed it badly by putting, like, a whitelist in that was case-sensitive. Then attackers realized you could just lowercase the exploit, and it still worked. Oracle then subsequently released a patch for that one that fixes it a little bit more properly. properly, which they've done out of band, which is good because it was getting exploited left, right, and center. You know, one of the guys around my office shelled WebLogic with it just today. So, yeah, definitely it's a bug that you should care about. And when Oracle goes out of band, you know it's really awful.
CVSS,
what do they say, 9.8? But it's, I don't think anyone's going to quibble about the 0.2 there.
No, and I guess I should say we don't know that it's being exploited in the wild, but there is a POC around, so that was an assumption on my part, but I think a pretty safe one. I also note that this story by Catalan actually includes comment from a young whippersnapper named Adam Boileau, who was apparently the principal security consultant.
Which he took out of Brett Winifred's tweet, so there we go. Full circle. Everyone involved. Self-licking ice cream.
Now, while we were away, a whole bunch of bugs got squashed. There were multiple releases from Google. I think Project Zero, we're talking about some, and maybe a couple came from Tag that were being exploited in the wild. We've also seen bugs in Chrome desktop, in Android, in Windows. Like, it's just been Ode Palooza lately.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of pretty serious bugs. I mean, some of the ones that Google have been talking about in iOS and in Chrome, are being used in the wild by real attackers. So that's pretty concerning. And good bug chains as well. I mean, some of the iOS bugs are, that's straight up remote to, kernel level privilege. That's pretty bad. Chrome bugs, sandbox escapes, also pretty bad. Windows local chained with one of those Chrome bugs. So yeah, definitely a lot going on. Google Tag, Project Zero, certainly burning a few people's expensive bugs. Although, hey, maybe the Chinese are throwing them away pretty cheap as well. So yeah, we don't know exactly who's behind it, but definitely time to patch, all of the things as always.
Now, a listener sent me this last bug we're going to talk about, which is in A10 Networks equipment, and it's a CVSS-10. It is CVE-2020-24384, which I think we're going to have to dub Unneeded Lobster. Oh, no, that one's already assigned, isn't it? So let's call it Gigantic Squirrel is that bug. This is a really nasty one affecting a whole bunch of equipment, and apparently this is the sort of equipment you find at the edge of carrier networks. So CVSS-10 at the edge of your carrier network is probably not what you want.
Yeah, I mean, they make a bunch of gear that does, TLS offload and application layer gateways for telephony protocols and all sorts of things like that. That's not a place that you want bugs. I think this one's in the management interface. Like, it's a little bit vague.
No one would put one of them on the internet. It'll be fine.
Oh, yeah. So it's probably just a straight up path traversal to code exec is normally what these things are, in the management interface for a perimeter network security device. I mean, A, very topical for this year because there's been a lot of that. And B, telco networks, all the sorts of things that you find this gear in, really you don't want owned through the edge.
But I guess the good news here is that telcos rapidly patch this sort of equipment when these sort of bugs pop up.
they always do that. You are correct. That is exactly what always happens. 100%.
Like greased lightning.
All the time, yes.
Like greased lightning. It's amazing. Now, look, have you noticed that we managed to get through basically the entire news segment without discussing the US election? I mean, that's pretty amazing, right?
It is a wonderful and beautiful thing, and I wish it would last. But unfortunately,
we do need to discuss Hammer and Scorecard. Adam,
oh my God, you mean that supercomputer? That sounds so amazing. I wish I had one of those.
Oh God. There is a conspiracy theory doing the rounds. It's been, it started a few days ago, and the conspiracy theory says that the US intelligence community have this supercomputer called Hammer. And that there's a program for it called Scorecard, which somehow magically alters votes. Now, this, I'm rubbing my temples right now, okay? In case anyone's wondering why I'm having trouble continuing. The origins of this story, the Daily Beast has an excellent report on this. The origins of this story, it's a guy called Dennis Montgomery who came up with this stuff. Now, this is the same guy who took millions of dollars from the US government because he had the intelligence community somehow convinced that he could decode instructions to Al-Qaeda cells from Al Jazeera broadcasts.
I remember this guy. This was such a, he scammed a bunch of money out of them too. That was like tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And he was taken seriously at the highest levels of the government, So, I mean, this is something to keep in mind just when we look back on some US presidents. So yeah, it seems to have propagated from this guy, and then Mike Flynn's lawyer picked it up. Some old guy who's apparently retired Air Force guy. He was also on Steve Bannon's online video show talking about it. But the crazy thing is it's starting to propagate right from the fringe into more mainstream outlets. So it's gone from like crazy guy to slightly different crazy guy with Steve Bannon to Fox Business to Fox News. Now, I contacted a guy named Matthew Gertz, for some comment on this. He works for Media Matters. He's a fellow there. And his main thing is looking at the relationship between the Trump administration and Fox News. And I've followed this guy on Twitter for years because one of the best things he does is he used to like watch Fox and Friends and then then watch the tweets popping out of Donald Trump's account as Fox and Friends went. So it was very clear that Trump was actually live tweeting Fox and Friends quite often, right? So, you know, he spends a lot of time looking at those connections. So I asked him to talk to us about this. So look, I prepared this little audio package. The first three things you're going to hear in it are, yeah, old retired Air Force guy on Steve Bannon's show. Then you're going to hear Mike Flynn's lawyer on Fox Business talking to Lou Dobbs. And then finally Fox and Friends, which is where it sort of arrived in the more mainstream media. And then you'll hear from Matthew Gertz sort of talking about how this thing's propagated. So here's that package now.
Hammer is what we call a SIGINT, a Signals Intelligence Program, that the NSA came up with years ago. The CIA picked it up under the Obama administration. The Obama administration took this system and they put in an application in this SIGINT program called Scorecard. And Scorecard changes votes at a certain point in the voting stream.
3% of the vote total was changed in the pre-election voting ballots that were collected digitally by using the Hammer program and a software program called Scorecard. In addition, they ran an algorithm to calculate votes they might need to come up with for Mr. Biden. I think they were very broadly used, but not by the vote counters. They were used by the forces in the Democratic operatives that had access to these programs through the government access points that they have and used it illegally to change votes in this country.
There's a software called Hammer and Scorecard used to flip votes from Trump to Biden. Is that indeed true? Don't you think if you're the president of the United States, you'd like to find out?
We've been tracking this absurd claim as it bubbled up through the right-wing media fever swamps to some of the most powerful pro-Trump figures at Fox. While I wouldn't say it's a constant drumbeat, the story has been treated as credulous by several influential programs. It's important to remember that a large portion of the president's supporters and the president himself get their information exclusively from partisan sources like this, where facts are rare and conspiracy theories are common. It's a seamless alternate reality that mainstream reporting does not penetrate. The vector in this case is Sidney Powell, a lawyer who regularly appeared on Fox to promote wild attacks on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. Powell made appearances to push the theory on Lou Dobbs' Fox Business show on Friday, then on Maria Bartiromo's program on Sunday, which airs on both Fox News and Fox Business. By Monday morning, the story had moved further into the mainstream of right-wing discourse, with Brian Kilmeade, co-host of the popular Fox News morning show Fox and Friends, talking up the theory on that program. Now, these are not just random kooks. Trump regularly watches all of these programs and personally sought advice from Dobbs in particular during his presidency, even having him conferenced into White House meetings. Given Trump's obsession with the network's programming, it wouldn't be surprising if the president himself started further trying to delegitimize the results of the election by pushing this absurd conspiracy theory. And that would put us in very dangerous, uncharted waters.
So yeah, I mean, I collected that audio and then I started, you know, preparing the package. And right on cue, Donald Trump tweeted a quote from Lou Dobbs this morning saying, "I don't care what state you're in," this morning, Australia time, I should say, "I don't care what state you're in, this computer voting system is wide open to fraud and intervention." So he's quoting Lou Dobbs there, and the president's comment is true, and wait till you see what's coming. right? So I just have a feeling that we're going to be hearing, unfortunately, a lot more about Hammer and Scorecard, because this is a, yes, this is the sort of thing, because they haven't even really defined the conspiracy. It's just computers, right? Like one person says it changes the thing on the screen before you touch it. The other person says there's algorithms and it's pre-poll digital something, something. But the fact that it's so nebulous makes me believe that it's the one that they're going to push. What do you think?
I mean, in a way, I'm kind of glad, because if they're going to push something that is quite so crackheaded and so nebulous, and, you know, that there isn't going to be hard evidence. Like, if they went some other avenue that was more legitimate, I guess, then perhaps they'd have more chance. Whereas, at least with this, right, it's just going to be a mess, because it's a bunch of people making spooky fingers at computers that they don't understand, right? And they're not going to be able to pull together a coherent narrative and
set of arguments. But that's what makes it perfect. That's what makes it perfect, because you can't rebut it.
Because it doesn't make any sense, you think? Well, I mean,
but how do you rebut something this nebulous? You can't fight it. That's why they're going to run with it. Because it's hackers, it's CIA and NSA supercomputer hackers, right? Like, you can't, because they're alleging that it's a secret thing, it's a secret invisible hand, it makes it impossible to actually chip away at it as a theory. It's going to work because it's so ridiculous. You see what I mean, right?
Yeah, I do. I don't want to believe you, but I mean, I do. I don't know. Part of me just wants to go, well, you know, look, in the end, it's a computer. I know how a computer works. There's a bunch of things we can go look at. Like, we ought to be able to argue this sensibly. But yeah, I guess you're right. If it's all just hocus pocus, right? It's just, you know, magic crystals except in computer form. Then...
what's witch? Yeah. Witches. I mean, witch. Witch. Witch.
If the Solaris box floats.
That's pretty much where we're at, right? So it's going to be a spooky old couple of months in the United States, but there you go. But I just wanted to bring it to everyone's attention that yes, you know, the fringe right is saying that the NSA and CIA hacked the vote with a supercomputer plugged into a SIGINT program. I don't know how that works, and they've got an application and algorithms to figure out where the votes go. But geez, you know, that's where we're at. And you know, I highly recommend following Matthew Gaetz. He's not Matthew Gaetz, the congressman, and it's very funny watching him get mistaken for that guy, which happens like daily, happens hourly pretty much, and it's quite fun. But yeah, he's definitely worth a follow. Link in the show notes. Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. Great to be back on deck, and great to speak to you again, my friend.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. I'll talk to you next week.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look back at the last 2 weeks' security news. Now, before we get into this week's sponsor interview, I feel like I owe our Russian listeners an apology, or at least a clarification. 2 weeks ago, I said Edward Snowden applying for Russian citizenship would bring to completion the most epic lifestyle downgrade in history. Now, said on its own, that really does sound like a needlessly nasty jab at Russia. And I've actually been to Russia. I spent about a week in St. Petersburg and its surrounds, and it's, you know, it's a wonderful country. It's a great place to visit. I had a really, really wonderful time, and I think Russia's a great place, so I should really clarify that the reason I said his move is a lifestyle downgrade from my point of view is that the weather sucks, okay? I live in a part of Australia where the daily average maximum in winter is about 20 degrees Celsius, which is like 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Snowden was living in Hawaii before he leaked. And to me, the idea of going from Hawaii to Moscow, like that weather change, is like my personal hell. So I would feel the same way about being stuck like in Washington, D.C. if I couldn't escape to the southern states, you know, in winter. Like, do not want cold. But yeah, look, one of our listeners in Russia reached out with a complaint, and he was right. I should have been more careful with my words just then. So sorry to all of our Russian friends and listeners. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Paul Lanzi, a co-founder of Remediant. These guys make an interesting product. Basically, it will connect to each of the Macs, PCs, and Linux boxes on your network, figure out which accounts have privileged access, and then go out and deprovision privilege from everything on your network. Then when you want to re-enable that privilege for certain tasks, you log into their network device via MFA, and you turn the privilege on for your account for a set period of time. Like, I need account X to have privilege for the next hour to do task Y, that sort of thing. And their goal is to stop lateral movement using compromised privileged accounts. So Remediant's customers use their tech as a sort of centralized PAM solution, and it's the ease of deployment which is what's made it popular. But that's led to this secondary use case that we're going to talk about today. As you'll hear, one of Remediant's MSP customers roped them into a ransomware response. They wanted to do a rapid deployment of Remediant to see if they could actually evict the attackers, because at that point they were just losing the battle, and it went well. So here's Paul.
So this is one of those classic stories of our customers are smarter than we are, right? So altogether, we're smarter than us. So we actually, this first started about 6 months ago when we got a call from one of the MSPs that we work with. And they said, hey, you know, we've rolled you guys out successfully to a number of companies, but we're right in the middle of an incident with a customer of ours that is not yet a customer of yours. And hey, we think that you might be able to help us. And the basic concept was that there was around 5,500 servers or so within this enterprise that were being compromised by ransomware. And this MSP said, we can literally watch this ransomware spread using a compromised privileged account. And we need a way of quickly locking down the privilege access across this entire company. And we know that that's one of the things you guys can do. Have you ever done it in the middle of an incident? And we said, no, we've never done that in the middle of an incident. You know, you're talking about trying to deploy this over a weekend. I think the fastest deployment we had done to date was probably 3 or 4 weeks before that. So they said, hey, well, you know, we know you've never done this, but would you be willing to try it? And we said, yes, absolutely.
So hang on, just for people who might not be clear, why can't you do that with native tools? Why can't you just go and like place some restrictions on those accounts in your Active Directory and, you know, lock it down that way?
Yeah, well, that would mean locking down every single account that has any privilege access and locking the users or the service accounts out of those out of that access. And that would be pretty disruptive because they wouldn't be able to get their email. They wouldn't be able to run non-privileged workloads, et cetera. So just turning off those accounts entirely in AD, generally speaking, not a great solution. You also can't roll out sort of the traditional PAM solutions using password vaults because, again, those are rotating credentials. You have to have a much deeper understanding of who actually needs that access and retraining all those people to then use the password vault for that access instead. So this MSP brought this problem to us because they thought that our technology might be able to uniquely be positioned to help them in this situation.
So really the idea here was to be able to recover from a ransomware incident without the attackers being able to just continuously reinfect and reinfect. This was part of an eviction exercise, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. So the MSP was watching the ransomware continue to spread internally. And every time they cleaned up a host, the ransomware would reinfect it again using these compromised privileged accounts. So unfortunately, the MSP wasn't making a lot of forward progress. And they saw this need to evict the attackers by evicting out the privilege access that the attacking components were using.
So how did it go?
You know, it went really well. And I forgot to mention this before, but, you know, this was right at the beginning of the COVID-19 crisis. And the company that I'm talking about, I can't name them, but they're a company that makes some things that are very critical to the COVID-19 response. And that was part of the reason why we agreed to sign up for this was, you know, we all saw the need for the critical need for these COVID-19 related supplies, and helping this company out was going to be one way that we thought we could contribute to the sort of global response around COVID-19. So it went pretty well. And there's actually a full case study about this on our website if you're interested, but it really all started on a Friday night, like all good enterprise rollouts do. It started Friday night, and we initiated the deployment. And within about an hour and a half or so, we had fully installed and we had completed the scan to figure out where all the accounts had privileged access. And that's across all the Windows, Mac, and Linux systems across our entire network. We had all that documented and figured out. And then about an hour after that, so that's when we started the rollout for Protect Mode, what we call Protect Mode. And in Protect Mode, that's where we, like you said, we evict out all of the persistent privilege access. And we get as close to something called zero standing privilege as possible. And that's basically the idea that if the account used to have, you know, privilege access on 500 systems, now it has privilege access on as close to zero as possible. And when it's time for an account to get that privilege access, when it actually needs that privilege access in order to do some sort of privilege activity, they log into our web UI, they multi-factor authenticate, and then they get that privilege access for a limited period of time. And so this conversion, yep.
Yeah, I mean, one question I got though is like, obviously this means you're essentially removing the ability of service accounts to do the things that they need to do, right? So, you know, you're talking backup agents, various agents running on these, you know, servers, workstations, whatever. Like, how do you deal with that problem, right? Because you mentioned before that if you just remove these accounts from AD or block them or whatever, right, you're going to be causing disruption. How is it less disruptive doing it this way?
Yeah, that's a great question. So most service accounts don't need privileged access to do the things that they do. A lot of service accounts are running application level permissions. That's fine. That kind of stuff can continue. The kind of permissions we're talking about here are when a service account needs that full admin rights. And in this case, there were about 6,200 service accounts that had that access. And we removed all of it. Now, I'm not saying that that is the ideal way to roll out a PAM tool, because it definitely will cause disruptions.
I mean, that's going to break stuff, right? Like, what did you break when you did it?
Yeah. It broke some stuff, but honestly, if I'm just brutally honest, it broke a lot less than we and the customer thought it was going to break. And part of that was because the customer had a rough idea about, like you said, the backup agents. We know what some of these service accounts are going to be used for, but they were all massively over-provisioned, which is not a huge surprise. In fact, your great interview with Turnbull, he mentioned this, right? He mentioned that the accounts tend to have way more privileged access than they should. And that's exactly what we found in this situation.
He did mention that in regard to Edward Snowden as well. And I think maybe listeners who were keenly listening to that might have realized that Malcolm Turnbull, Australia's former Prime Minister, maybe said a little bit too much in that part of the interview. Would you agree with that, Paul?
I could neither confirm or deny it. It does happen to be at the 5 minute and 40 second mark of your interview with him. If anyone wants to go back and re-listen to that segment.
A few people caught it and went, oh, really? Anyway, people can go back and have a listen to that and make up their own mind as to whether or not he may have inadvertently revealed some classified information there, but do go on.
Yeah, neither confirm nor deny it. But just like he mentioned there, in this particular environment, we found massive over-provisioning, right? There was something like 1.5 million admin rights. So if you took up all the accounts that had admin rights and all the service accounts that had admin rights across all the computers and summed them all up, it was something like 1.5 million persistent admin rights. We were able to remove all of that. And like I said, break a lot less than we thought we were going to by the end of the weekend. But since we were in the middle of an incident response, you know, breaking things was already happening, right? Like, you're in the middle of an incident recovery, things are going to break, right? And so we knew that we could help limit the damage of continued reinfection.
Well, I guess what you're saying is it was easier to deal with some of these broken accounts than to deal with, you know, ransomware crews continuing to run around setting stuff on fire with impunity.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, fast forward, Saturday of the weekend was all about just sort of monitoring, watching for, like you said, broken things. And by Sunday morning, we were having Pam and eggs.
Pam and eggs. I love it. That's great. So that was the first one of them you did, but you've done more, haven't you?
We have, yeah. And so once we saw that this actually could, like, our technology actually could be rolled out over the course of a weekend. And again, this is not the ideal state. Definitely things, if you do it this way, things will break. But if you're in the middle of an incident, things are broken already. And so we've now repeated this four more times across four other customers in non-COVID-19, thankfully, in non-COVID-19 related verticals. And it's proven to be a pretty effective way to use our technology in every one of those cases. And again, I can't claim credit for having thought of this idea myself. This was brought to us by really smart prospective customers that needed a fast way to lock down privilege access across our environment.
But I mean, that's always been the strength, right? Like, the whole point of your tech is to be able to do stuff on Windows networks quickly, right? It's the fact that it's light touch, which makes it good. Because if you were going to roll like a 6 month project, you may as well go to something like, you know, cloud-based auth. It's always been for people who don't want to do that because they don't have the bandwidth to do it. This is about quick things that get you a long way, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. And also, there's a difference between authentication and authorization that often gets missed, right? And so what our product does is really focus on the authorization. Frankly, how you authenticate to those endpoints is really between you and your authenticators, right? So if it's Duo, Okta, whatever, like whatever the multi-factor authentication is, even the first factor can be something like a CAC card or something other than a username and password. It can be biometrics. We don't really care because we don't stand in the authentication pathway. It's really about focusing on the authorization and thinking about, all right, for these Mac, Windows, and Linux systems, how is privileged access authorized? And how can we shift that to a just-in-time model with continuous detection for any changes in privileged access that we didn't expect?
So I guess then I'm getting corrected a little bit in that by the sounds of things, that you will handle the post-authentication, authorization part. Even if someone's using Okta, you can then, you know, take those authentications and then handle the authorization part and just lock that down a bit tighter. This isn't specific to AD.
That's exactly right. So we care a lot about what, once you've been authenticated, what do you have privileged access to? That's what we, that's the problem we solve. That's what we wake up every morning caring a lot about. We trust that really smart partners of ours like Okta, and we are an Okta certified partner, care a lot about authentication and doing authentication in new and novel ways.
So I guess the question becomes, like, how are you going to start doing some, well, I mean, I guess this is marketing around the incident response stuff, but, you know, is this something that you see as being a big opportunity for Remediant? Because it sounds like if you are dealing with trying to evict attackers from a network that doesn't have these sorts of controls, like it does sound like there's probably a few people who are listening to this who they're not planning on having to use your tech this way, but like I imagine there's a few people listening to this in 3 months from now, they're going to remember this interview and then maybe give you a call. Like, do you see this thing as being a big opportunity for you guys?
First of all, I totally agree with you. We hope that no one ever gets ransomware. If ransomware went away tomorrow as a concept, I would be a much happier person, along with probably every other InfoSec practitioner on the planet would be a lot happier. But I think that this is a proof point about how rapidly our product can be deployed, even in environments that aren't suffering from ransomware. So even if you know that you're not in the middle of an incident and you just want a really good PAM solution to come in and clean up the privileged access.
So this is more about like the proof in the pudding, right? Where you're like, ha, we rolled it out in a weekend, you know, we're awesome, rather than, hey, our future is in incident response and recovery.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a perfect proof point that it can be rolled out effectively very rapidly. Now, that said, we have a playbook now. Now that we've done this a half dozen times, we have an internal playbook about how we can help the next customer even better during an incident recovery and help clean up their privileged access very rapidly.
All right, Paul Lanzi, it's always a pleasure to chat to you, my friend. That's really interesting stuff. And I know that these sorts of wins are few and far between, so it must have been exciting to be a part of a few of them this year. I hope you stay well, my friend, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks, Pat.
That was Paul Lanzi there from Remediant. You can check them out at remediant.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.